KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Eric Westervelt. You may know Tommy Caldwell as one of the first free climbers to ever summit El Capitan's Dawn Wall in Yosemite, widely considered one of the toughest climbs in the world. But you might not know he did it with only 9 fingers, or that years before, during a climbing trip in Central Asia, he was kidnapped and held hostage by armed Islamist rebels.
There were several times during that 6 days of captivity where I felt like we couldn't take another step, and we had to, and then you'd break through that. I don't think I ever would have believed that the Dawn Wall was possible without having been through that.
Rock climbing icon Tommy Caldwell's new memoir is The Push. He joins us next on Forum, after the news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Eric Westervelt with NPR, sitting in for Michael Krasny this week. Welcome to this hour's Forum. In 2015, Tommy Caldwell and his climbing partner, Kevin Jorgensen, made history when they completed the first free climb of the Dawn Wall face of El Capitan in Yosemite National Park. Outside Magazine dubbed this granite face arguably the most difficult ascent in the history of rock climbing. One reporter likened Caldwell's feat to climbing a plate glass. In his new memoir, The Push, Caldwell talks about growing up small and uncoordinated, how his life changed with a bodybuilder dad who challenged him to push his limits. Also covered, a climbing expedition that went awry when he and his friends were kidnapped by armed Islamist rebels. Caldwell is considered one of the world's best rock climbers. His new book is The Push, A Climber's Journey of Endurance, Risk, and Going Beyond Limits. And Tommy Caldwell joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
Really, really good to talk to you. Your dad was a bodybuilder and a mountain guide, I got from reading the book. And he started taking you on these incredible hiking, camping, and climbing adventures when you were, I would say, kind of insanely young. I mean, when you were four, you sort of started climbing. Your dad was taking you up there. I mean, did that seem to have a huge impact on your athletic skills and spirit? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even before I was four, actually, one of his favorite stories to tell is actually taking me out in this raging blizzard and digging a snow cave and actually changing my diapers in a snow cave. So I was
age three or two.
Yeah, when I was 3 years old. So he was a bit of an out there father. Yeah.
I mean, tell me about the impact that had. I mean, at 12, you climbed Colorado's Diamond Wall, which was the highest elevation big wall in the lower 48. I mean, you were 12. You kind of some dangerous things with your dad at such an early age. Did that change your perception of sort of risk and challenge when you were getting pushed literally at this young age?
Yeah, it absolutely did. It was funny. Back then, my dad was out there. He was like an outlier. Everybody thought he was crazy. Nowadays, it's funny. I have my own kids. Mm-hmm. And when I take my kids into the mountains and, you know, I post a photo on Instagram of my son like leaping into my arms off a 20-foot boulder or something, people are like, "You're the greatest dad ever." It's totally changed. It's accepted now, whereas it wasn't back then. But yeah, the risk element was kind of a huge reason that I wrote this book in the first place. I needed to sort of figure out what this all meant to me, because I was out there in a way living in the battlefield from a very young age. And I became not only sort of lit up by the environment, but maybe a little bit addicted to the stimulation of it, which got me in trouble a few times in my life.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that. Was there any tension from reading the book that your mom was more of a subdued, laid back, sort of more traditional mom, and your dad's out there changing your diaper in a snow cave and making you climb walls at age four? Was there a tension there? Talk a little bit about that.
I mean, generally not. My mom was amazingly, I guess she just put up with my dad taking my sister and me out and doing these kind of crazy things with them, and she was okay with it. Mm-hmm. And she was actually, I mean, she would come a lot of the time even. So the tension wasn't too big for the most part.
And by your late teens, Tommy, you turned pro basically. You became a full-time rock climber. I mean, how hard was it sort of making a living as a rock climber?
As climbers, the culture, especially back then, was one of this sort of dirtbag existence, like living off of no money was
in
admired.
A van down by the river.
Yeah. It was actually admired. It was funny. Like, if you had a normal job and you made enough money, you weren't a real deal climber in that community.
Right.
But the funny thing was, is when I became a, quote, professional climber, the profession didn't really exist. Like, I was one of the first children or teenagers who started to make money off of it. So I didn't see it coming. I just knew that I loved rock climbing. I sort of admired the dirtbag culture. After high school, I figured I'd go live in my Honda Civic and see what happened. And I never expected it to become something that would sort of sustain me until this day.
Talk a little bit about the hardcore culture of rock climbing as a vagabond existence, sort of as you put it, at least it was. Was it open to new people, or was it kind of like what some have criticized the surfing culture from being is a bit insular, like you've got to be part of us for a long time to be accepted. We're not open to newcomers.
I would say it's more open to new people than the surf culture, or it was mm-hmm. back then, as long as you shunned the mainstream and devoted everything to climbing, you were accepted. And so I was in communities of people that were, you know, young kids like me, but there was also former doctors and lawyers that would show up and kind of become part of this culture and become enamored with it.
So devotion and spirit are counted above all.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And now it's changed a little bit, though. Now people find a better balance. I think they manage to do it more on the weekends or, you know, manage their lives. I just think there's a lot more opportunity these days. So
I'm speaking with rock climbing icon Tommy Caldwell. His new book is The Push, A Climber's Journey of Endurance, Risk, and Going Beyond Limits. Bay Area climbers, whether you're a weekend warrior or the hardcore climber, we want to hear from you. What are your questions for Tommy Caldwell? Join the conversation at 866-733-6786. Climbers, 866-733-6786. Or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or email your questions to forum@kqed.org or post them at kqed.org/forum and join the conversation. Now, your ascent, it's free climb, for the uninitiated, myself included, talk a little bit about the difference between free climb and what it was, sort of old school, traditional, and what the difference is.
Yeah, free climbing is a hugely confusing term to most non-climbers. Everybody thinks that word free means that you're not using ropes. If you fall, you die. What I do generally is not that. We actually climb in the same way you do if you go to your local climbing gym or something. You climb the surface of the rock and you have the ropes there to catch you in case you fall. And so why it has that word free is because it needs to differentiate itself from aid climbing, where you actually climb the equipment. Like you put anchors in the wall and then you grab onto those anchors and you climb those. And that's how big walls were historically climbed, like El Capitan. You take, you know, bits of metal and you pound them into the cracks with hammers. And now they make things that you don't actually have to pound into the cracks so they don't damage the rock. And then you ascend the equipment. That's aid climbing.
But the old way was sort of either drilling bolts or now these kind of bolts that go in and expand.
Yeah, cams or nuts. Mm-hmm. That, you know, there's companies that make these gadgets that just fit into the rock naturally without harming it.
I mean, there are these scenes, Tommy, of you and Kevin on the Dawn Wall I saw in the movie Valley Uprising that I found really unnerving. I mean, I was watching it last night, and you're climbing this granite sheet of rock, holding onto these tiniest sort of nubs of rock, these little bits. I mean, I came away from that saying, you know, Tommy, are you sane?
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of people have that reaction, and because visually it is intense. I mean, being on
from rock to rock.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Yeah, sheer granite face that's thousands of feet tall. You're oftentimes falling up to 60 feet and being caught by this rope. It's a very, very engaging and scary environment. The thing about El Capitan specifically, though, is that the rock is really good. Ropes are strong. So although it looks so intense and scary, it's actually not all that dangerous. I mean, I think that's why I became so enamored with this route, is because I could go out there and I could have the challenge and I could have the excitement and I could have all that stimulation. But I was, you know, relatively certain I was going to live through it. Not to say there are no risks. You have to be very experienced. And there is occasional ice fall and things like that. But I think they were negotiable. You know, we could figure out ways to make it safe.
But I did see in the Valley Uprising movie, I mean, some of the times that you stumbled, you're not falling 2 feet. These are long falls. You have a rope to help protect you, obviously. But, you know, you're getting slammed against a granite wall.
Yeah. So when you go into the climbing gym, a lot of times the ropes are pre-strung for you. Mm-hmm. It's not that way when you go out and climb outside. You have to carry them up below you, which means you anchor the ropes to the wall as you go up. Mm-hmm. So essentially, if you fall, you fall down to that last anchor plus that far again. And so it's this constant game of judgment, like how far can I go between the anchor points? Stopping to place those anchor points takes mm-hmm. a lot of energy. So it's really a game. It's a fun game that's hugely complicated and engaging.
Pete on social media writes in, does Tommy consider himself something of an addict? I mean, climbing El Capitan 2 times in 24 hours. I mean, what does he do for fun when he's not on a wall? The first question, I mean, you said you enjoy the rush, the intensity of the climb and of the challenge.
Yeah, I enjoy the challenge, the rush. People think of climbing as this adrenaline sport. And generally, I think if adrenaline is involved, something's going wrong. It's more of a sport of control. Mm. But having said that, I am absolutely an addict to the lifestyle. Mm. It gets you out in the mountains every day. It provides these focal points and it becomes all consuming. I think most people that get into more adventure climbing become lifers. Like they never get it out of their system. It's not something you generally dabble in.
Interesting. Well, lifers or weekend warriors, join the conversation at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Your question for climbing icon Tommy Caldwell. I'm wondering, what was it about the Dawn Wall that, what was it that made you want to try to conquer this? It was one of the last sort of major, probably the hardest to climb potentially in the world. What made you want to go up against that and try to be the first?
So when I was a teenager, I got absolutely addicted to climbing on El Capitan. I mean, the Dawn Wall wasn't the first free route up there. There's a bunch of existing ones. And I had spent, almost 20 years of my life going to Yosemite for 2 to 4 months a year and climbing these existing routes. And for me as a rock climber, it was sort of the most engaging thing I had experienced that, all other climbing kind of paled in comparison. And so through that, I worked my way up. I did the easier routes first and I did progressively harder ones. And I gained more experience than possibly anybody. And at some point I was like, how far can I actually take this? I would go, I would try a route. I would work on it for a month. I would do it. And I just would repeat that process over and over again. I was like, can I push this world to a new place? Like I knew that I was at a place, I was at a place in my climbing where I could actually explore something in a way that nobody had in the past. And as a professional athlete or a climber, that's a pretty enticing thing.
And your dad sort of took you to Yosemite all the time as a kid. You kind of grew up there, correct?
Yeah. We'd go on summer vacations every year to Yosemite. And so I would watch my dad aid climb the wall from Yosemite Valley. And, I think if you've ever been to Yosemite, you look up there and that wall just looks impossible. It looks like there's no way to climb it. And tourists come to the valley who aren't climbers. And if you're a climber, you tell them there's climbers up there. They don't even believe you a lot of the time. They're like, there's no way that somebody could ever climb that. And so to a climber, that's it's this constant process of taking things that look improbable or impossible and then breaking them down to their elements and therefore making them possible. And that's a pretty fun thing to be able to do.
Philip writes in on social media, as an outdoor dad myself, what I appreciate most about Tommy is his ability to balance being a dad, husband, and adventurer. The question is, how do you maintain balance between those roles? And has being a dad made you any more conservative when assessing risks? Are you kind of treating your kids like your dad treated you?
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the beauties of social media is you portray exactly what you want to, and it gives this perception of balance, which I think I do a pretty decent job with.
Like there's
balancing.
Facebook life and there's real life.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. I think I do a pretty decent job of it, and that's because I'm in this place where I can multitask. I can bring my family with me all over the world. And climbing actually is an incredible way to raise your children. Like we spend a lot of time traveling all over the world. They learn languages. They're outdoors every day. They're super engaged. We're mingling with communities all over the world. So I make child raising and climbing merge. That helps. The other part of your question was the risk assessment element. That's something that I'm always trying to balance. You know, I definitely have taken it too far at times in my life. And as a dad, that's a pretty serious position to be in. Mm-hmm. And big adventure climbing, the more risky types of climbing, is in some ways the most addicting. And sometimes I wonder if it's, you know, a good kind of addiction or a bad kind of addiction. There's a great quote by this author named Tom Hornbein, who's a friend of mine, who said, maybe we can view risk like a drug, beneficial to the organism in its proper dose, too much or too little can be a bad thing. And so I think about that a lot. It's about finding that right balance.
It's interesting. Yeah, someone who's covered some conflicts, I was always looking for the balance too of risk reward. You know, I've got to do a job, but at the same time, you assess the risk all the time and have to decide how far you want to push it. Clearly, in your sport, you've pushed it pretty far. Austin in Berkeley, you are on the air with Tommy Caldwell.
Hey, thanks so much, Tommy, for sharing your experiences. I knew of you. I was a big rock climber from 89 to about the year 2000 and been up El Cap twice.
Oh, cool.
So I know the experience there. And I just wanted to comment on something and extend upon what you talked about in terms of climbing being miscategorized as an adrenalized sport. I think... I currently work as an architect and also write on creativity and innovation. And what I recognize, the reason that I was drawn to climbing for so many years is because it wasn't that, again, I was wanting to be freaked out and scared. It was those moments of flow state that were so profound for me. And I love the way that climbing, you know, when you're actually on and leading, you know, and in that state, it's total focus. There's that sense of total oneness. But it's also balanced by when you're at the belay station, you tie yourself in and you're safe at that point. Then there's this hugely expansive awareness, which is also incredibly intoxicating. And the combination of those two things, the basis of that focus and that complete, you know, mind, body, and spirit, just physicality of moving up a beautiful line like El Capitan, mixed with that ability to sort of like allow your mind band outwards into space once you're done with the pitch. I just thought that was one of the most beautiful things that, you know, a person can experience. And, you know, now that I'm in my late 40s, looking back on those times, I'm so grateful to have that as a young man, that spirit of adventure there. It's just really touched my life in a lot of meaningful ways.
Great. Thanks for your call, Austin. Austin, on the beauty and sort of the mind-body connection of climbing.
Yeah, I mean, Austin did a great job in just that minute of sort of encompassing what the wonders of climbing are, why people get so hooked on it. Yeah, I actually rarely run into people who have experienced that and then don't do it as much, unless it's just life getting in the way. But once you get hooked on it, you kind of stay hooked on it.
We're going to take your calls some more, but join the conversation at 866-733-6786. I'm talking with Tommy Caldwell. His new book is The Push, A Climber's Journey of Endurance, Risk, and Going Beyond Limits. And we should say we've embedded a clip of the Valley Uprising film at our website, kqed.org/forum. And let's go to some more phone calls. Robert in San Francisco, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. Hey, Tommy. Hey, wanted to ask who you believe, in your opinion, is a climber that you think is one of the best or the best, or who do you idolize and why?
Oh, man, climbing has got so many different subcultures. And so I have mentors and heroes and people that I idolize in all different aspects of it. You know, I would say when I was younger, I was climbing a lot with this total phenom named Chris Sharma. And Chris has this way of sort of being able to look into the future and see what is going to be the next big cool thing. And so he's somebody that I always really looked up to. But also all the climbers involved in what they call the golden age of Yosemite rock climbing, when all these walls were being climbed for the first time in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s, people like Yvonne Chouinard, Royal Robbins, Tom Frost. I think I look at that era with a lot of envy. But really, my biggest hero in a lot of ways has always been my dad.
Hmm. Is your dad still around, and is he supporting your efforts?
Yeah, my dad is still around. He still climbs a couple days a week. And yeah, I would love to say that I get out with him all the time, but life gets in the way. But he just has this vision. He has this ability to spread Stoke more than anybody. You know, he's just such this excited guy, and that's his gift to this world. And I was privileged enough to have that from the time that I was really, really young.
That's great. Jeff writes in on social media, you recently went to Capitol Hill, Tommy. Can you speak to that experience? You know, what did that meeting say about the future of the outdoors? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, climbing's in this amazing place right now where it's no longer a niche sport. You know, my whole life it was this very, very tiny culture. And now because of climbing gyms and just the increased popularity, it's growing bigger. And we're at a place right now where it's grown to a point where we have a bit of influence. And so yeah, I went to Capitol Hill and did this event put on by the American Alpine Club and the Access Fund called Climb the Hill, where about 60 climbers, it was a mix of people from those two organizations as well as professional climbers, went and set up meetings and talked to senators. And really it was mostly about public lands issues. Mm-hmm. And it was crazy to go there because, first of all, a lot of people in that world are climbers now, which that didn't exist in the past. But they're also so excited about climbing that we were able to get meetings with these people and kind of and move the needle a little bit. I felt like we were successful at moving the needle. And at the end of this day, we had this sort of slideshow event in the Senate hearing room. And there are senators in there that were saying that they had never seen that room so crowded. Mm. Which was kind of a trip for, you know, being a bunch of climbers on Capitol Hill and getting the Senate hearing room totally packed.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So was it partly about access to climbing spaces or public lands access in general?
Yeah. I mean, the Access Fund is preserving access for climbers. But right now it's a bigger issue kind of surrounding the Bears Ears National Monument. Mm-hmm. And, the review of the Antiquities Act, it's really in response to that. The climbers, more than other outdoor enthusiasts, are sort of taking on this battle and really trying to help people understand the beauty and the value of these natural places, not only for climbers, but for all outdoor recreation users.
Let's take some more phone calls. Andy in Mill Valley, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me. I was wondering if I had a friend in 1996 who fell off of a route on El Capitan. He was soloing. Not climbing without protection, but soloing the Zenyatta Mandata route. And so I have two questions. One, Tommy, do you know the route, and can you comment on it from personal experience or otherwise? And then secondly, when a member of your community should fall and die doing this wonderful sport, what generally is the reaction, and how do you process that given the risk calculation?
Thanks for your call, Andy.
Yeah, Andy. So I do know the route Zenyatta Mandata, and you know, El Capitan has gone through this interesting history where people first climbed it and realized it could be done, and then for a long time the limits were pushed, or the standard was pushed, by doing progressively more and more dangerous routes where the natural protection was quite poor. And Zenyatta Mandata is, you know, towards the upper end of difficulty in terms of the crack systems are not that well. You put in this protection that can just basically fall out of the crack when you take a fall. And so for me, that's why I love free climbing, because I tend to climb things where the protection is a bit better, but the challenge really comes from the physical aspect of it. But accidents do happen. I would say there's an average of maybe one death a year on El Cap, which isn't so bad, honestly, when you consider that there's thousands of people climbing it each year.
All right, we got to go to a break, Tommy, but you can join the conversation at 866-733-6786. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Eric Westervelt. We're talking with rock climber Tommy Caldwell. His new memoir is The Push. He speaks tonight at Patagonia's San Francisco store at 7 p.m. and I believe Planet Granite in Sunnyvale and Copperfields in Santa Rosa at 7. That's tomorrow. And right before the break, Tommy, Andy talked about what happens when someone in the climbing community dies. This is a dangerous sport. It's not for amateurs. Talk a little bit about the impact on the wider community when someone passes
away. So, I mean, generally El Cap, I think, is a pretty safe place to climb, like I said, and Yosemite is pretty safe. But climbers do like to go to these bigger mountains, these more alpine environments where there's a lot of snow and ice. And we do have members of our community dying quite often. One of the most famous climbers in the world died just a few weeks ago on Mount Everest mm-hmm. in an unexpected accident. And I'm understanding more and more all the time how much of a game of Russian roulette big alpine climbs are. And so I think I'm gravitating away from I'm moving away from them. Actually, some of the scenes in my book deal with friends dying and then mm-hmm. it kind of hitting home how dangerous this sport can be.
And the big alpine climbs, especially, it's when a weather front can come in. Suddenly, it can change everything.
Yeah, I think generally it's because of snow. Like when you're on snow, you're not actually attached to the mountain. And so, it falls down on your head and mm-hmm. wipes you off the mountain. And so I've had maybe 20 relatively close acquaintances die over the years, most of them on snow. And that starts to hit home. I think most climbers, as they get older, mm-hmm. They realize that they should probably tone it back or just go for broke.
Yeah, right. Yeah. A listener on social media asks, Tommy, why is climbing so much more popular now than in the past? I mean, you just talked about going to Capitol Hill in a packed room. What has changed? Is it rock climbing gyms? Is it a lot of things?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of things. I think it's spurred by rock climbing gyms. Now you can go to any major city in the country and experience rock climbing in an indoor setting that's very controlled. It's a superior way of like indoor fitness. Like mm-hmm. I think it's taking over a part of the fitness market. People understand that it's way more fun to go climbing than run on a treadmill.
Right.
And it's so accessible. These gyms are big. And I think something like 90% of all new climbers will probably never climb outside. So this hugely emerging indoor culture.
That changes the sport as well, but it popularizes it.
Yeah, popularizes it. It changes it. But also I think that it's better understood now. Like everybody thought climbing was a sport just for adrenaline junkies and thrill seekers, and now they understand that it's way more diverse than that.
Join the conversation at 866-733-6786. We can take some more phone calls now. I believe we've got John. You're on the air with Tommy Caldwell.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been a rock climber all my life. I was never a great rock climber, but I found that as I had children and took them on progressively more difficult climbs, it really started to scare the hell out of me, whereas before I didn't have a lot of fear. And you talked about, your interactions with your kids climbing, and I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on how that changes the math surrounding risk and reward.
Yeah. So I think climbing is this great exercise in learning to navigate the minefield of life. Like we all encounter hardship, and when you're out there climbing, you're trying to essentially find a safe way to do something that is relatively risky. And all of life can be considered like that in some ways. And so I think it can actually teach your children some really good skills if done properly. Mm-hmm. I definitely understand the aspect of people getting out there and getting scared. It's just about finding that balance, I guess. Mm.
Tommy, there's a riveting section in the book where you and friends are climbing in Kyrgyzstan in 2000. You're taken captive by the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, I believe, these well-armed Islamist radicals. You're held for nearly a week. You do escape. Pick up the story for us, if you would, of what happened.
Yeah, so this was my first big international climbing expedition. I was 21 years old. We went into a region, being from the United States and being relatively young, we just figured the mountains as this remote, safe place. But in Kyrgyzstan in the year 2000, there was a rebel group that came over this mountain pass. It's a pretty complicated political situation, but a lot of it is it became an opium trade trail, a way to move opium over the borders through these remote mountain passes. The Kyrgyz military came to fight them, and we were at the point of collision between these two forces, and we were captured for 6 days. And it was this absolute life-changing event for me. I mean, I think I view my life in terms of everything that led up to it and then everything since.
There's essentially a battle between a military and these Islamists. You're climbing. You get taken captured. And tell us how you escaped from the group.
Yeah, a war broke out, and so we had to abandon everything along with our captors, and we didn't have food or warm clothing, and we were on the verge of hypothermia for 6 days. We all lost, you know, somewhere around 20 pounds each.
So you're cold and hungry and held captive in the mountains.
Yeah.
And on the move.
Yeah, and hiding from the Kyrgyz military, like spending our daylight hours like stuffed in these damp holes and under boulders without moving. It was, you know, just unbelievably painful and scary in every way. And as we, you know, as we sort of wasted away, as we got closer and closer to death, everybody was, you know, even our captors, they were, you know, it became obvious at some point that we just couldn't withstand this forever. We're either going to escape out of the valley and become hostages for who knows how long at some military base, or we were just going to die in the mountains. And so the way that we escaped is on our sixth night of captivity, the head rebel went to try and find food, and we were left to climb up this big 2,000-foot mountainside with one remaining guy. He was probably about 19 years old, a hired mercenary, and we were in exposed terrain. We were climbers. He was not, and it became really obvious that our opportunity to escape was there. It was going to be quite easy to just walk over to this very intimidated rebel, push him down the mountain and run away. And so that's what I ended up doing. And yeah, like I said, it was a life-changing moment.
You had to do what you had to do and push him off the cliff.
Yeah. I pushed him down. I thought I had killed him. And then we ran to the nearest military outpost, and that's how we got out of there.
Was writing this book in part, you know, trying to help you come to terms with that incident and the trauma of being held captive and having to push someone off a cliff?
Yeah. You know, I generally think that you should wait until later in life to write a memoir. You should be at least, you know, 70 or something. Right. But the Don Wall media craze, because that story got so much attention right afterwards, created the opportunity. And so I started to work on the book. But I didn't write about the Don Wall first. I went back and wrote about this moment in Kyrgyzstan. And I think it's because it was a moment that had happened to me, and I knew that my whole life was changed by it, but I had never let myself fully meditate on it. And so when I sat down and wrote that scene of actually pushing this guy, it brought me back. Like, I could smell the smells, I could taste the taste, you know, it's like I could feel the fear, and it was cathartic, and it started to connect the dots in this way that made me realize that I had to finish this book. I had to go back and do this with the rest of my life. I think as climbers, we tend to view life through this very narrow lens. Like, we focus on the things that are going to help us accomplish what we want to do, and we block everything else out. And I found writing to be the opposite. You have to see everything suddenly. And that's, you know, as a dad who's a climber, I felt like I needed to do that.
You were young when this happened, arguably a bit naive. You're rock climbing during in a conflict zone. This was kind of, as you've written in the book, a kind of coming of age moment for you.
Yeah, it was. I learned a ton. And I think as climbers, we always, you know, we kind of view risk in this interesting way. We say to ourselves, like, if you pay heed to all the potential dangers, you will never get out in the mountains in the first place. Like, you kind of need to live without fear. I think that experience taught me that you need to assess risk much more seriously than I did at that time in my life.
Speaking with rock climber Tommy Caldwell, his new book is The Push, A Climber's Journey of Endurance, Risk, and Going Beyond Limits. And we'll take some more phone calls. They are climbing up the phone lines here. Matt in Oakland, you're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I noticed that people who are involved in professional sports retire at different ages and with different post-retirements. Football and basketball players just stop. Golfers, I assume, keep going, and professional dancers become teachers of professional dance. How do you see your rock climbing career going? Let's assume you live to be 85. How are you going to pull back?
Well, first of all, my dad is 65, and he still climbs all the time. So climbing, you can tone it back, and you can still go into the mountains or into the climbing gyms and have a great life of climbing that, you know, even when you're not physically as strong, there still is a venue that's great. And I think the longer that you climb, the more you learn to appreciate the smaller details. And so climbing is going to be something that I always do. In terms of it being a profession, yeah, it's going to change, obviously. I think my career has been built on the strength of my fingers in some ways, and that degrades over time. But I also know so much about this world that is now becoming popular. I think the idea to teach, to kind of spread the knowledge of the wonder of this sport, I think it's a life-changing sport that can do a lot of good for a lot of people. And so, you know, writing this book was in some ways an attempt to learn how to be a storyteller, because I think if you can effectively tell stories, that's the way to make the most profound impact.
It's very well written. I enjoyed the book. It was.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that.
So you were busy climbing from an early age, but you kept up your writing chops. So
well, it's funny. I dropped out of high school essentially. I was a terrible student, and I never, I think if you were to ask my teachers in high school if I would ever write a book, they would probably just drop to the floor.
Right.
But climbing does have this great history of literature, and then all the adventures I went on as a kid or as a teenager and into my early 20s, whenever I'd come back from these expeditions, the magazines would ask me to write articles. And so I learned how to do it through that. The editors of these magazines became my teachers and made me – I really fell in love with the process of reliving through writing. Mm-hmm. And so, this book was just kind of a bigger way to approach that.
And speaking of not retiring, a listener just tweeted at us, my 63-year-old male partner and me, a 55-year-old female, are listening from Corsica, where we're on a sport climbing trip. So bravo to them, and thanks for listening. Join the conversation. We'll take some more calls at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or get in touch on Twitter or Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. And let's go to John, who's in Glen Haven. You're on the air. Welcome to Forum.
Thank you. Good morning. I wanted to kind of touch back on the public use element. I lived in Yosemite for a summer, and I've ice climbed in Colorado, and so I've been outdoors a lot. And when you go to Yosemite, you realize there's, you know, a lot of people there, 3.5 million visitors a year. So how do you kind of balance your love of nature, climbing walls, that pristine wilderness, you know, finding that, and then also kind of the human impact of those sort of actions, you know, let's call them sports.
John raises a good question. You know, it's hard not to go into the wilderness and not have some kind of impact.
Yeah. Climbers build a more intimate relationship with our natural world than most. Like, it's an incredibly intimate way to be in nature. Like, you're climbing on these rocks, you're walking on the glaciers that are receding every year. You really learn to understand those impacts, and therefore most climbers become environmentalists in some ways. John Muir is the most classic example. He was a very avid scrambler and really hugely instrumental in starting the national park system. So I think for the most part, climbers are going to be the ones that save nature rather than the other way around. Having said that, there is impact. But I think that, you know, climbers, they just love nature so much that they, you know, these organizations pop up which figure out ways to manage the impact. I think, you know, the fact that climbers reached out and went to Capitol Hill in such this huge force and made a difference, like, these are all testaments that, you know, I'm hugely optimistic about the future of what climbing will do to our natural world.
And William writes into us, climbing may be the only sport that forces you to be in the present. The mind doesn't want to wander. Talk a little more about the mental aspect of it when you're, whether it's the Dawn Wall or a less challenging climb.
Yeah, I think one of the previous callers, maybe it was Robert, was talking about the flow state.
Mm-hmm.
And climbing does produce this in a pretty incredible way. Like, when you get out there and you're fully engaged and you achieve this flow, it's magical. I mean, I would say there's different levels of it, but kind of the highest level of the flow state is something that I've only achieved a handful of times in my life, I would say. And I think constantly about those moments, and I'm always trying to get back there. And it's a very magical thing to find.
You write eloquently in the book about the moment when you guys reached the top of the Dawn Wall, and you mentioned the sort of the media frenzy. It drew a lot of attention to climbing when you guys finished that first free ascent of that. But talk about the moment when you and Kevin were nearing the end and finished that climb. And you've got this dichotomy probably of this intense personal moment for you guys, but at the same time, there's, you know,
I don't know, a CNN truck, an NPR calling you, wanting to talk to you?
Yeah, so the Don Wall media event was kind of this paradigm-shifting thing. Like, people, I had felt like I lived my life in a relatively small community of climbers. I was a professional climber, but that meant that just climbers were following me. The Don Wall, something changed. The New York Times wrote articles, 13 billion media impressions or something like that. It was a huge media deal in the world of climbing. And it was very strange for me because I, you know, even the idea that we were using social media from up on the side of a big mountain, it was strange for me. I've been climbing for so long, I was a bit of a curmudgeon about that at first. But Kevin Jorgensen was the one, my climbing partner, Kevin, really brought that to the table and started doing Twitter updates on what we were doing up there. And that was that was kind of the spark that spread. And so by the time we topped out, there was huge attention. It was funny because we were up there on the wall and we were still in our little intimate circle. But we could look down, we could see the news trucks as we were topping out. We could look over to the east and see all these people that had gathered. And
this was like an expedition. You had support. I mean, you were up there for days. So it wasn't just you guys. You did have support sending you supplies.
Yeah, we were making a documentary film. Mm-hmm. So we had several filmmakers with us, and which were our good friends. I mean, it was a big team effort. And we were up on the wall for 19 days. And the media, exploded in that time, in those 19 days. So for me, climbing has really been about this journey. Like, I have these goals, but they're really just focal points. They're just a way to motivate me to be out, sort of pushing myself and pursuing these challenges. But in a way, when I actually accomplish one of these things, it's exciting because you've been working towards it, but it's also a bit of a letdown because it's like the end of this love affair. And so that moment that you were describing before we topped out the Don Wall, that was the magical moment. You know, me and Kevin and our buddy Brett sitting on a ledge as the sun hits the top of El Cap, and we're like, this thing we've been working on for 7 years is actually happening. Like, it happened. And it was this really bonding experience, this incredibly just this great adventure that we had over 19 days. When we got to the top and the media was there, for me, that was weird. I've never been a hugely comfortable public figure. So the fact that there was all these cameras on me, and I felt, I just felt a bit self-conscious. It was cool in a lot of ways too, because like the president called and congratulated us, and it created all this opportunity, which has been great in my life.
It's been great for the sport as well.
Yeah. And it's great for the sport. So it's a bit of a mixed thing, but the climbing for me is like very soulful, and sharing it with the world while you're giving a lot to the world, which is great. You're also giving away a lot of yourself, which, I don't know, it's this very mixed thing.
Well, a listener writes in on social media, I've never climbed before, but always watched the climbers in Yosemite with great envy. If I want to try my hand at this sport, is it better to start at an indoor gym or take lessons in Yosemite or somewhere else? What advice do you have for people that, like this listener, are really interested in the sport but just have never taken the plunge?
Yeah, I think the easiest way to get started is to go to your climbing gym. And I think everybody just sort of the best way to get involved is find that community. Climbing is a very community-oriented sport. So if you go to the gym and you take a lesson, that will get you started. But you need to find the community. And there's community of little kids. There's, elderly people. I mean, there's all sorts of communities. Everybody's going to be able to find community in the climbing gym. And so you can use it as just a way to get fit. But the people who really are the ones that become the environmentalists or the ones that become the lifers, they're the ones that go to places like Yosemite. They get out on the natural rock and they start to develop that intimate relationship with climbing and with nature.
I'm talking with climber Tommy Caldwell. His new book is The Push. 866-733-6786 is the number. And let's take a few more calls. Ed, you're on the air. Welcome to Forum.
Yeah, hi, how are you? I've been listening to your program, and I just remembered I was in France this year, mostly in Paris, and I visited a friend outside of Paris, about 40 minutes by train. They call them the Rocher de Fontainebleau. These are the rocks of Fontainebleau. I was wondering if your guest is familiar, because it's kind of a destination for, it's not like El Capitan, but it's almost like a primordial area where these enormous boulders are just strewn all over the place, and they have these, some of them almost take on like figurative, there's like a huge rock that looks like an elephant and one that looks like a tortoise. Does your guest know about this place?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I'm be curious too, some of your favorite spots as well, Tommy, outside of El Cap.
Yeah, so I'm very familiar with Fontainebleau. I actually just returned from 5 weeks in Fontainebleau about 3 weeks ago. And this is this place that people have been climbing at since like the 20s. And you can, like, I would have a 1-year-old daughter and a 4-year-old son. And the reason we spent so much time there is because you can just wheel the stroller right to the base of the boulders.
Oh, cool.
And go climbing with your family. And the French culture is so amazing in that it's really a family sport there. People go climbing and then they bring salads and they make them at the crag. And it's like this big all-day picnic where you get to go rock climbing. And it's a great, you know, we were there. We ended up every day with like 5 or 6 other families, and there'd be kids running all over the place, climbing on the boulders. And it was just a super fun place. I think that people come from all over the world, specifically to Fontainebleau, because it is so family friendly, as well as being one of the best bouldering locations in the world. And bouldering in some ways is the best training for the sort of bigger, more adventurous forms of climbing, as well as being just a great sport in its own. So yeah, Fontainebleau is one of my favorite places. Yosemite is as well. I love to go to Patagonia in southern Argentina. You know, there's countless great climbing locations all over the world.
And Tommy, a listener tweets at us, what's your main thought at the difficult moments? And from watching, you know, the Valley Uprising last night, you know, there's some amazing pictures and images of climbers hitting those difficult moments, including yourself.
Yeah. I mean, for me, the difficult moments are the moments that create flow. They're the moments that make you double down. Like, you need that challenge to understand what you are capable of. Mm-hmm. And so they are what satisfy that deep curiosity that I have within myself to understand sort of the limits of where we can take our bodies and our minds. So I kind of climb for those difficult moments in a lot of ways.
And I'm wondering what's next for you. I mean, if you've done the first free climb of this, the Dawn Wall, you've written this book. I mean, do you have other challenges ahead, or do you feel like you've become more unofficial ambassador for the sport?
Yeah, both. I'm sure there'll be more challenges. There's been at least 4 or 5 times in my life where I've done a big climb. I'm like, it's never going to get better than that. Like, it's all downhill from here. And then something always comes up. Like, I always find something new. Right now, I'm not looking for that because I tend to get so focused on things that I sort of push out everything else. And I want to just be there for my children these days and enjoy this part of their lives. So I'm consciously not trying to pursue big climbing objectives, at least for now.
Be a dad a little more.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And I find ways to multitask, but I just understand I do get a little bit too obsessed sometimes.
Very good. Eric in Livermore, let's take a question for climber Tommy Caldwell.
Yeah, hey, Tommy, this is Eric. We fly hang gliders up through the Sierras and stuff, and we were on the east side 1 year, and we were trying to shoot through this gap on Split Mountain. It's south of Bishop. I don't know if you know where that is. And we just came ripping by maybe 3 feet over the top of the ridge at maybe 60 miles an hour, and right as we got to the edge, up here's this ice climber coming up the other side and just scared the heck out of everybody. And so we ended up circling around and talking to these guys, and then actually ran into them like 2 days later at a bar. And he said, man, some guy in a hang glider almost took me out. And I said, well, that was me. Let me buy you a beer. You know, do you ever run into hang gliders when you're flying around, or when you're climbing?
Well, that's funny you said that the climber scared the heck out of you, because I imagine you scared the heck out of the climber.
Right.
In the same way. You know, I think, since I climb so much on El Cap, what I run into more is base jumpers. They come flying by you, think it's rock fall, but you end up kind of hanging out in the same community after the climb. And yeah, so it's all a community of sort of adventure lovers.
Great. Yeah. Good question. Jennifer in Palo Alto, you're on the air with Tommy Caldwell.
Hi, Tommy. Thanks for having me on the air. I'm enjoying this talk. I have a son who's an avid wilderness person, and he's currently doing a round trip of the PCT. And I'm a mom that tends to worry. So He's warned me that the PCT is nothing compared to what he's going to do after that, and he is an avid rock climber. So I was wondering if you have any advice for moms out there who worry about their sons but also want them to be happy and pursue their wilderness dreams.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Yeah. I think the fact that your son is hiking the PCT is, you know, that's a very, very safe thing to do. And so, I mean, I don't know what he's planning.
The Pacific Crest Trail.
Yeah, the Pacific Crest Trail. I don't know what he's planning after that. But, you know, I think climbing is potentially risky, and there's definitely risky ways to do it. I push that farther than most. And I think that the vast majority of climbing can be done very safely. And, yeah, I think probably for most people, like when people tell me not to do something, like if my parents, if my mom, for instance, was to tell me not to do something, that probably would have made me want to do it more. So I don't know if that gives you much solace, but
it's about finding that balance, I guess,
yeah.
as you've talked about. Pete in Alameda, you're on the air for Tommy Caldwell.
Hey, Tommy, thank you for taking my call. I'm looking at a photo of you on the Dawn Wall, and I'm just really curious about it. It looks so desperate and so thin that that I'm wondering how much confidence you had in your protection, and you know, it's just it's really an amazing photo because it's so blank.
Thanks for your call,
so anyway,
Pete.
Your
safety. Good question for Pete.
Yeah, I mean, we spend a lot of time up there analyzing the protection, figuring out the moves. We rehearse these moves on the Dawn Wall, much like a gymnast would a routine. And so we get very, very familiar with how good the protection is, how long of falls we can take. One of the great things about big sheer rock faces like that is that there's nothing to hit generally, and ropes are strong. So even if the protection's bad and a lot of it pulls out, there's usually eventually something that's going to catch you, and it's going to be pretty safe. So on the Dawn Wall specifically, I'm not too worried about the protection. Yeah, like I said, it's more the big snowy mountains that scare me.
We've been speaking with rock climber Tommy Caldwell. His new book is The Push, A Climber's Journey of Endurance, Risk, and Going Beyond Limits. Tommy, thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
I'm Eric Westervelt, sitting in for Michael Krasny. And Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lorberg, Susan Britton, Jeremy Siegel, and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. I'm Eric Westervelt, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.